This podcast is brought to you by the award-winning Australian Geographic magazine. Subscribe today and never miss an issue. Go to australiangeographic.com.au. If you're curious about the world around you and freedom from the crowds is your idea of luxury, then Coral Expeditions is exactly the right cruise line for you. For 34 years, Coral Expeditions have focused on taking like-minded guests to remote cultures and rarely seen natural habitats, with personal service and warm Australian hospitality. Join the Australian pioneers of expedition cruising for an intimate and unique small ship adventure experience. Their fleet of five modern vessels will take you to explore the Kimberley, Tasmanian wilderness, Cape York, Papua New Guinea and beyond. Visit coralexpeditions.com and find your freedom. That's www.coralexpeditions.com. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. This episode, I'm talking to John Rumney. John is a true living legend of the Great Barrier Reef. Over the past decades, he's mended the relationship between tourism operators and scientists who sometimes don't get along. As a witness to the mass coral bleaching events on the reef, John is trying to find practical solutions. So I'm really excited to be talking to John today on this episode of Talking Australia. John, thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. I love sharing the reef with everyone.
So I want to go right back. Tell me about the very first time you ever dived to the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, it was back in 1974, and I came over here from the U.S. To really explore the reef. I'd read about it and heard about it and everything, and I guess it was a childhood dream. But I'd already even done my residency permits, you know, to immigrate to Australia, knowing that I wanted to have a really good look. So went out. In fact, the first time was at Green Island, and it used to be $2.70 to go out on Hale's Ferry to go out and
a lot cheaper.
Yeah, snorkel, and it was absolutely amazing that even that inshore reef, Green Island, had this amazing amount of fish. And so since it was quite cheap and we were new here, I think we ended up going about 50 times, every day. Some days we'd never make it off of the jetty. Just drop our bags, snorkel, take off, and no, it was amazing dance of life.
And you've been involved with the reef for 40 years plus. So what kind of kept you on the reef from that moment in 1970?
Well, I don't think there's always more to see. There's always more to learn. But I think the adventure is there anytime you put your face in the water. You don't know what will swim by. And again, as you get more experience, I think you become maybe, I guess, a little more braver, or, you know, you look for the next level. And so at first, you know, the first shark you saw was, wow, that was amazing. And then you start going, well, you know, where are the bigger ones and what's next? And luckily, I guess I had blinders in that was very much my focus. I was always a nature kid. I think I knew more about Australian snakes when I was 12 than I do now.
And you kind of developed your career on the Great Barrier Reef, but you mentioned that you'd come over here. And I mean, what was your intention? Were you already planning to work on the reef? And what were those initial jobs that you had?
Well, in fact, I initially left university to get a commercial dive ticket, and then come to Australia as a commercial diver to then build that, business. But then you go into tourism, because I experienced a little bit of sailing in the Caribbean. And I knew that, you know, that was, one of those moments in your youth that, you know, adjust your direction. But it was definitely, I was going to make my living, you know, on the Barrier Reef. And I didn't quite know how yet in that. But I ended up not doing the commercial diving and came over here just to have a look. But again, I didn't know what. And it ended up that I'd never met a commercial fisherman, you know, growing up. That's not where my family lived and what we did. And but then through a friend, I started fishing with him. And then I went, ah, this is the way. I can live on the Barrier Reef and make a living. So that, you know, and it ended up then with my girlfriend then, but then Linda, my wife, we ended up building a boat, a 9-meter boat, and ended up living on that for 5 years at sea, you know, no house, no car, etc. And that was sort of the level of, I guess, passion or interest in that wilderness adventure. So we would, everywhere from Port Douglas north to TI, we've, you know, dived and explored the reefs and the islands, and it was just fantastic.
And because you have that experience on the reef from so long ago, I'm wondering, at what point did you kind of say, wait a minute, things are starting to change here?
Well, I think consciousness is an evolution, you know, just even in like society, you know, what is not okay now was fine 10 years ago and 20 years ago. And I came here really with that adrenaline and the pure, I guess, excitement of the marine wilderness. And then, again, I was commercial fishing. Fine, you know. That all made good sense to me. But then you started to see impacts. And you also started to, in the early 80s, I had some of the first research charters on the Great Barrier Reef from the Marine Park Authority. And that, again, by having those people on my boat for 50-something days over a period of, you know, months, gave you a whole new perspective. And it started to be, well, there wasn't enough money for the research. There wasn't access. The average marine biologist, even today, spends 2 weeks at, you know, in the field. The rest is, you know, writing papers, teaching classes, that. So there's, you know, a really lack of opportunity. And I guess I saw being with the researchers that made it really much more interesting, because I love just the pure adventure side of being in the water with the animals. And all of a sudden, again, you have a paradigm shift of perspective.
So it's kind of like your interaction with researchers made you more aware of what was happening on the reef.
Absolutely. And I think that's always then became one of my, I guess, signature dishes, is that it's this science for solutions, and the science builds the awareness, which then builds positive outcomes. And you'll see many conservation groups and research groups that have that same triangle. And what we're doing now, which I'm jumping forward here, is with Great Barrier Reef Legacy, is really identifying that what is lacking is, yes, research opportunity, funding for sure, but it's the lack of connection with the people and the public engaging and absorbing and connecting with the reef and the science, so that we get better stewardship. And I think that's really where we're focusing. And the steps from way back in the 80s till now have basically been a progression of now trying to increase that connection. And my being in tourism for 30-something years, you personally saw that happening every day that you took these people out, and you built on that. And but now we need to take it into every classroom and into every community, because what we're trying to do is not be an advocacy group, though we believe in all the advocacy points of view. It's that we need to create the material and the connection with the public, so they, you know, demand better leadership.
Mm. And we're going to go more into the Great Barrier Reef Legacy, but I want to go back to something that you mentioned about tourism and your involvement with researchers. Now, ecotourism, it's a very, very popular word these days, and you are kind of one of its pioneers on the Great Barrier Reef. And so I wanted to go back to what tourism was like on the Great Barrier Reef pre-ecotourism. You know, did it do much damage? What was going on pre that kind of ethical tourism?
Back in the beginning, it was just take people out, throw them in the water, have them see what there was, and come back. And sort of some of the level of interpretation or misinterpretation was that, yes, you know, giant clams would grab you and hold you, and you know, like, it was, any story was a good story, but again, and it was deemed by the conservation groups that tourism was one of the evils. You know, it was mining, fishing, and tourism was right up there. But also that was a lack of appreciation of how tourism was even evolving then. It was a user, therefore it must be bad.
Right.
Rather than how do we make it the most responsible? And the fact that tourism, out of their own self-interest, you know, found it easier to have moorings, like, and not anchor, because then they could pick it up. It'd be easier to do. So, you know, one of the biggest impacts back in the early days was the fact that there was anchoring on the reef. So once the management authority, you know, came to grips with that and started making that a management tool, and also therefore restricting numbers and trying to create, in the park management, they call it the amenities effect, and that's so that there's not too many people too close, and also allowing access for the public, you know, for the recreational people to get out there and feel like the reef is still theirs as well. So in that zoning, they also did certain reefs are managed for X number of people, like low use, medium, and high use. So that all came in true force in 2003, but that, I guess, ecotourism evolution and this kind of management came hand in hand in the late 90s.
I want to talk a little bit about what the perspective is on tourism on the Great Barrier Reef today, and I guess tourist operators and the Great Barrier Reef. I guess in the media, there's kind of this debate played out between tourist operators and scientists on the Great Barrier Reef, and that, you know, they just have a relationship that won't work and things like that. I guess one of the things that has been kind of said was that maybe the negative coverage of the reef will impact business, things like that. So I'm wondering if you could kind of weigh in on that. What's the ideal relationship between tourism operators and scientists?
Well, I think there's an absolute positive one, and it's that next level of ecotourism or research tourism. So in fact, back in our early days, we jumped straight into research tourism before ecotourism was invented. But it was that idea of getting more knowledge, more passion, and the more you know, the more you're interested, and et cetera. So, but the real key now is that, and many of the operators are starting to embrace the higher level of interpretation. And in fact, the tourism industry identified that there was a lack of adequate interpretation, and they backed the idea of having the master reef guides, getting a higher level, because that would help create the appropriate experience for a tourist that's now seeing a reef that isn't as good as it was in the postcards.
So what does it take to be a master reef guide?
They basically do a course. It's only a few people at a time. It's an intensive thing, and they're, appointed by vessels, and also people can volunteer to do it. And they just and it's also the start of building, I would say, a career path for these people. And that's something that's always been lacking. You know, you would get people come and be young, really keen, and then they, you know, can't move up. There's nowhere to move except if you become a boat owner or management. So now you can, you know, increase your level of experience, but also I would say respect and opportunities to guide. Like in the, around the world, you know, you have restricted areas and you can't go there without a guide. So this is maybe a first step in then allowing I'm going to say positive access rather than management that's saying no, like, no, you can't do that because you're going to create an impact. But informed guides can absolutely minimize that impact. And tourism has gone from back in the, you know, 80s and 90s deemed as a bad thing to now it is the primary reason to save the reef or to save environments around the world. Mm. They are the economic drivers, and some people really are upset with that because you want to save the animal for the animal's sake. But I think going back historically, the fact that here on the Barrier Reef, when we did the rezoning from 4.6% protected to 33% with the Cairns Plan of Management and the whole rezoning of the reef, that would not have happened if it wasn't that tourism identified that the reefs were their assets. and that they wanted their dive sites to be in green zones so that they had more fish and healthier coral to show their tourists. So there was now an economic reason rather than a purely conservation reason. And I think general feeling is that if it hadn't have been for the tourism interest and support, we would have got 10% of the reef protected rather than the 33%.
We're taking a quick break and we'll be back with John Romney in just a moment. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We're back with John Romney. I want to go into, the economic value of the reef, because I guess it's a little bit of a controversial topic in that I know in 2017, Deloitte Economics, they put a price tag on it and they said it's worth $56 billion. And people thought, well, no, it's priceless. Why are we putting a price tag on something like this? So I'm wondering what your perspective is on that. Is it useful or is it kind of, misinterpreting things?
No, I do think it's useful because you look at our political system and how we vote and the fact that it's a short-term election cycle and it's a very lobby-based system. It's not a, just generic democracy doing the best for the people. It's a lot of vested interest. So you have to, define benefits in economic and employment terms in order to get an outcome. Because, you see everywhere around the world, but especially here, that if it doesn't have an economic value, then just move aside. Like, this is progress, employment. So, we have not socially or democratically evolved to, try to use the total picture, the triple and quadruple bottom lines of, social values and, all of those things to make our wisest decisions. But right now, it's very clearly, you have your economic and your social and your environmental, if you want to have three. And what we're seeing now is that with the decline of the reef due to CO2 emissions, that we are now looking at having to, try to save the world to save the reef. And that's a big ask. Whereas before, when we were dealing with issues on the reef, we were dealing with water quality protection, fishing, tourism, things that are almost internal or in-house manageable. And I want to say that having the bleaching come and UNESCO, threatening to revoke the World Heritage listing has prompted, the government to then say, well, we're going to now do a token investment to be seen that we're going to deal with water quality. So there's some money there. But out of the millions that it's been over the last 10 years and the negligible improvement, I just want to say that I'm for doing everything you can do. So I don't want us not to do the water quality. I want us to do the best fishing management. We need to deal with the runoff from golf courses. Every sector can do better. But if we don't address the terminal cancer issue of CO2, then we are heading down, an unsavable future. And so it's like, view your body, your right arm is, water quality, agricultural runoff associated with crown of thorns killing the reef. Your other arm is, cyclones, fishing, and all, assorted other issues. But the core, and you don't want to run around life with two broken arms, so you need to fix those. But if you don't deal with terminal cancer, it's almost pointless what you do with your arms. Mm-hmm. So this is where we're at. And the barrier reef and the reefs of the world, let's really clarify that. This is a global situation. We're talking about a whole coral ecosystem around the world under threat because they happen to be sensitive to temperature. That's their biology. They've lived hundreds of millions of years. And so, again, we're not saving the barrier reef for the coral. We're saving the coral of the what we see it right now. But 100 million years from now, there'll still be coral. We may not be here, even 100,000 years. It will be different, but we won't have the assets. We won't have the biodiversity. We will have missed the discovery of the solutions that are out there, you know, in the pharmaceutical industries, but food security itself. So, and a lot of people associate it with only temperature, but with that same CO2 is going, and some people, you can say, well, okay, we've always had temperature changes. Well, if you talk about the CO2 that we're putting in the air, which is undeniable, like there's like four questions. Are we putting CO2 in the air? Yes. Does it get absorbed in the water and in the ocean? Yes. Does that change the acidity of that water? Yes. Does that affect the life forms in that? Yes. That affects our whole food chain and our oxygen production, etc. So we need to be looking at this, you know, seriously. This is not a luxury item of, oh yeah, it's just a few tourism operators that are going to be out of business. Well, we'll get them jobs in the coal mines. You know, is that what the people are thinking? No. So, you know, we need to race to renewables. And people as individuals can only do so much. They can change their light bulbs, think about what they're doing in life, you know, try to go plastic free. Everybody needs to become aware. But we, the people, need to move the governments. No one party's free of blame here. Forward with a vision. Like, this is World War III against ourselves, and it's our habits. So I think that's what people don't get, and I'd like to feel that the time has come, and it has come that we're drawing a line in the sand. And before that date, you can say, you know, you don't know what you don't know. But we now know. The science is there, and every day there's more science, and the predictions that were made 20 years ago are being held true, and many of them are being worse case than they were even predicted. But from this date forward, you have the ability to know, and therefore you become responsible. And if you then act irresponsibly, then you're liable. And insurance companies are coming to this effect. You know, governments need to be held accountable for their decisions, especially if their decision, and they say they know that there is climate change and that there are these issues, and they're still not, you know, they're still supporting the lobby-based friends and supporters and that are funding them, then there's a direct line of, you know, lack of duty of care. Australia is, you know, the master of duty of care.
I'm wondering.
And we're not having it in our own in our own neighbourhoods.
Mm. I'm wondering, you would have been there for when the coral bleaching happened in 1998, but then you would have also witnessed the back-to-back bleaching. Mm. I'm wondering how you felt during that event. Yeah.
Well, the first one was, wow, well, this is, you know, and then we supported through our boat, the Undersea Explorer. We gave access to researchers to get out there and study it and see the things. And so it became, again, it's one of those points where your awareness is lifted other than just being a tourism operator because of the type of guests that you're catering to. So we had, you know, on one of my best projects of my life, the Undersea Explorer, we gave free space to researchers every week from all different fields. And therefore, we got to be involved and learn about each of those subjects. So one of them was this fluorescence and then the coral bleaching. And then, so it did a bit of an alarm bell. And then, but it went away. And we sort of, everybody went, oh, wow, that was interesting. And certain, you know, eminent scientists, we were going, that's a warning sign, wake up. But everybody ignored it. Then they had another bleaching in 2003 and 2004, and there was one at Great Keppel. So, you know, there started to be these symptoms. And then the 2016 was devastating. I mean, that's where I think you went into mourning and or fear that wow, you're too big to be threatened. Great Barrier Reef, like it's not one little island isolated. That's no recruitment, is now under stress, and that and whoa, That was really bad, really serious. And then to be followed by 2017 was almost like the second punch and you're down and out. Now, what's fantastic is it is big enough that we have these reserves. It's still not, even in the bleached areas, there are pockets. But you went from, I want to say, 90% live and a few dead spots to now a few good spots. And luckily, you're a tourism operator that has a good spot, and the people that go out with you still come out of the water every day, even from 2016, going, gee, that's the best thing I've ever done. And we want that. And we, so that's the quandary, is how do you get the Save the Barrier Reef, or save ourselves, you know, with those threatening things and not hurt tourism. So, you know, we need to, but like everybody else, quietly lobbies government, you know, and takes them to dinner and does donations and everything that they do. So you can have one face that's pro, this is what it's like, and have real life footage of the people coming out, what their reactions are, you know, do some positive marketing for sure. But we need to be solidly in there, the whole tourism industry, and in fact, the agricultural industry, everybody needs to be going, no, we need to save ourselves. So again, we're going to save the Barrier Reef for ourselves, not for the corals.
Do you think there's an argument to be made that perhaps in taking tourists to specific spots that are still there, it might be giving people the idea that the Great Barrier Reef is healthy? And should there be an educational kind of, you know, oh, this area is great, but remember, you know, we're going through coral bleaching, climate change is happening?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been basically lobbying for such a program for the last couple of years, and I believe that we have the mechanisms to do it. The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, under all their permits, there's an interpretation requirement, etc., that isn't really activated. So you could have a climate change or coral bleaching / climate change poster on every boat that then also led to more interpretation and offered a dialogue so that the people, again, had it in context. So that is part of Master Reef Guide as well, is that those people are then going to be more informed on how to do that. But no one likes to be lied to. No tourist likes to be lied to, either in the marketing or when they get here. And that is what came out of the questionnaires to tourism a few years ago and why they started the Master Reef Guide program, is that the replies were coming back on, we weren't getting a straight story. So absolutely. And the thing is, anyone that's been here 10 years ago and dived and snorkeled and comes back, they're the ones that know. Oh, it wasn't like that before. Now, but the fact that we still have great spots, we need to really celebrate because they not only because of business, but they are also the refugia. They're the future, you know, seed banks of, you know, for the next generation, the next coral spawning. And there's some great science going on, like here in Australia and around the world, on how do we help coral reefs. And until really about 3 years ago, it was just hands off, the nature will fix itself, we just have to limit our impact. Well, now it's like, uh-oh, no. We now have to become proactive, and what's the science that we can help? And many of the tourism operators are, in fact, investing in the science. Like, they are getting involved in research programs with reef restoration and seeding and that. And so they're stepping up and making their boats and their platforms available, and they're also independently funding research projects at their sites, trying to grow little coral nurseries and that. And the first step of this proactiveness started with the Crown of Thorns program. And again, then industry finally picked up, and with AMTO and Grabumpa and that, they now have Crown of Thorns boats that are going primarily to tourism sites and trying to hold the Crown of Thorns at bay. And right now, there's not a big issue where we are up here. It's the Crown of Thorns play is moving south. And again, but then it's eating the coral that is not been bleached, you know. So maybe they know not to bother to eat up here. There's nothing to eat, you know. But
I want to go into, I know there was a survey that was released maybe a few years back that said 69% of tourists who visit the Great Barrier Reef are there because it's kind of like this thing that's been termed last chance tourism, as in it's going to die, so we have to quickly go and see it. I'm wondering how you feel about that as a tourism operator.
How long is it last chance tourism? Is this a 10-year marketing plan? Or is this, you know, like until we deal with CO2 and have solutions, or have we farmed, have we gone really much more, you know, Disneyland, and we're farming corals and holding them in our spots and attracting fish so that we still have something to show people? So I do believe we are, in fact, somewhere in the beginning of this. But that's since 2017, but it's very complex. It's not so. We may have had the bleaching, but what stopped the bleaching from moving farther down the Barrier Reef was a cyclone. In fact, both 16 and 17, and the 17 one obliterated the Whitsundays. So they got knocked back and had, I would say, more percentage coral cover died than the bleaching. But it's from a physical damage, not a, you know, temperature or health damage. So, no, the threats are very real. And maybe, you know, again, having this really good science on the resilience of corals and the farming of corals and how to get whatever is naturally happening to accelerate or, you know, relocate and all that kind of, I'm going to say, down to the molecular level of how corals function and what they do, is really money well spent, because we don't want to really be the people that, you know, killed the Barrier Reef.
You mentioned, you know, resilience in corals, and I know that you and the Great Barrier Reef Legacy have been really forward in terms of trying to find those corals and things like that. But I want to go back a little bit further before that and talk about the inspiration behind the Great Barrier Reef Legacy.
It was an evolution. Few really like-minded, you know, people, but not all, some biologists, some filmmakers, some researchers, some media, you know, everyone went, what can we do? I think everybody felt, what can we do? But now this was started in and evolved from Low Isles Preservation Society, you know, and other organizations, and also seeing that some fantastic advocacy groups like, you know, Australian Marine Conservation, WWF, those guys have been on the ground doing really good work, you know, coral, not coral, those issues. But we felt that we needed a way to get better connection to, you know, what you love, you'll care for, you know, and we need to get more people to love the reef and connect with it.
There's so many media stories around what's happening on the Great Barrier Reef, and I'm wondering, what are some of the solutions?
Well, I think there is definitely hope. Anytime you give nature a chance, it bounces back. So, you know, with the younger people stepping up and saying there's an issue, that was one of the most hopeful things, you know, the students going out on strike. But the thing is, we have, like, on the Great Barrier Reef Legacy, you know, we have a fantastic director, Dean Miller, Dr. Dean Miller, and he is really, I guess, uniquely talented in being able to combine the science with the media and the education. And so, again, getting the word out. But the support of the science, like, we raised the money and funded expeditions that would not have happened up to the far north to study the most damaged areas if we didn't engage, you know, the business sector to support the research for saving their assets. So, you know, and I just think that, you know, as long as we get more people to engage, connect. And so I really, you know, welcome everyone to, you know, check Legacy out, see if that's something that, you know, suits them. But whatever, wherever you are in society, pick an NGO that you support, because they are protecting, they are invested, and you will get multiple times your money's worth instead of you trying to do a campaign or whatever to get them to support, you know, your environment and, you know, your quality of life in that environment. So I think that's and the science for solutions is, you know, Australian Institute of Marine Science is doing fantastic work, you know, different places around the world. We are launching basically the world's first, and Legacy wants to get all the partners together and the public and start a live coral biobank. And that is so, like, people know what a seed bank is, some people, you know, and that you hold them and freeze them forever so that you have something to draw from in the future and study or repopulate. Well, the idea is corals, if they're just given clean water and sunlight, they almost live indefinitely. So if we get enough of these coral specimens from all the, you know, refugia of coral around the world, then they can live for the next 30, 50 years, not in nature, and we can re-bring them back and re-bring back that biodiversity of coral, which we are really in the threat of losing. Right? We are already losing coral species on the Barrier Reef and other places around the world. So this will be a you know, coral, live coral biobank for the future, and we think we can do it incredibly cost-effectively and with great industry partners. So that's one of our big hopes, and we, again, welcome all the institutes and aquaria and even coral home collectors to come and get involved.
Thanks so much for chatting to me today, John.
My pleasure, and let's spread the word.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with John Rumney. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.